I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know that gasoline smell? It smells like victory.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smell of Victory podcast, a line of effort that is part of the national security website, divergentoptions.org. I'm your host, Bob Hine, and I'm joined today by Steve Leonard.
Hey, everybody, back again.
And this week, we are joined by Dr. Corey Shockey, the Deputy Director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, former Director for Strategy and Requirements on the National Security Council, former Deputy Director for Policy and Planning at the State Department, former Distinguished Chair of Security Studies at a small vo-tech school on the Hudson River. You may know as West Point, but probably most well-known as a member of the Strategic Advisory Board on our blog, Divergent Options.
Also, exactly right.
Also author of numerous books and articles, most recently Safe Passage, The Transition from British to American Hegemony. Corey will lead our discussion today of hegemonic shifts, China's future, and what a rising India might look like, and a little bit more. Corey, welcome to our show.
It is such a great pleasure to be with you guys.
Thanks. And before we begin, we want to remind our listeners that this podcast does not contain information of an official nature, nor does the content represent the official position of any government, any organization, or any group, but it should. So, that being said, in your book you talked about hegemonic shifts, but is there a possibility of dual hegemony?
No. By definition, hegemony is a power strong enough to set and willing to enforce its preferred rules of order on the international scene. So unless two states have a perfectly parallel set of national interests and they project those identically and with no competing priorities onto the international order, hegemony is by definition singular.
So I have to go back, though, to my war college studies where they talk about regional hegemony and the fact that the United States is the only regional hegemon right now, thus allows us to be a global hegemon.
So Tom Wright makes the argument that it is America's regional dominance in each of several regions that adds up to global dominance. And there's something to that, as you suggest, but that's not the same thing as being a hegemon. Being a hegemon means you can establish rules of order and you're willing to enforce them, and that creates economies of scale. A regional hegemon, what they mean is the strongest power in a region. A hegemon is almost by definition global, gentlemen.
Fair enough. Steve?
I look back on the bipolar environment that we had during the Cold War, and looking at that as a hegemonic struggle of the earlier part of my lifetime, and it appeared to end with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I think you noted as that was the zenith of American hegemony. Do you ever see that struggle being completely finished, or do you see a time and a place when Russia can spark a second round in the Cold War?
So I think Russia's a threat to us now, but it's a threat to us through its weakness, not through its strength. And hegemonic struggles are struggles for power. They're about who gets to determine the rules of order. And one of the things that makes me less worried about Russia than I was about the Soviet Union is that the Soviet Union had the ability to set and enforce rules. And there were times when we feared they could impose those rules on us. One of my favorite things to go back and look at is the CIA assessments of the Soviet economy in the mid-1950s. Because they were just sure we were about to be overtaken by the Soviet Union's industrial efficiency, which was, of course, nonsense, but we didn't realize any better. Nobody thinks Russia's about to overtake the American economy. Nobody thinks the Russians have the kind of creativity and political liberalism that would bring tiresome lefties like those who populate Silicon Valley and who create the world anew. Nobody thinks they're doing that from Russia. And where Russia is attempting creative asymmetric challenges, election disruptions, cyber attacks, there, the West is perfectly able, although slow on the uptake, as free societies tend to be able to identify the what the Russians are doing and develop counters to it. So Russia's a threat to us through its weakness, not through its strength. And to the extent there is an authoritarian power that has the potential to set new rules, that power is China, not Russia.
Interesting.
And I agree with you completely on every single one of those points, Bob.
So one of my, fascinations in history is the law of secondary and tertiary and unintended consequences. And in your book, you identify one of those, which, you know, for us and for most people that are not avid historians, although you do not claim to be, but the Venezuela debt crisis as being a pivot point between U.S. and British hegemony. Now, I look at another possible pivot point. I'm interested in your views on this. When you go back to the Taiwan Strait crisis of 96, where we sent a couple of carriers into the South China Sea, my view is that was could potentially be viewed as a pivot point, and that it motivated China to start seeking a Bahamian navy and because they just did not want to be embarrassed by that again. And can you see that as a one of those possible pivot points that will have caused a rising China and a competition for hegemony?
So I think you and I have a slightly different definition of pivot points. I do certainly agree with your judgment that the Taiwan Straits crisis, in which we sailed two aircraft carriers in to show them that we mean business, that's a moment of revelation for the Chinese, that their ideology and their rhetoric is at odds with their actual abilities. But the reason the Venezuelan debt crisis is so interesting, what makes it an inflection point in the Anglo-American transition, is that the United States asserts a different set of rules and the British comply. So that's why it's a power transition, because Britain was still the stronger power, a rising power, asserted a different set of rules, and Britain complied. So that's why it's a pivot point. What would make Taiwan parallel is if the Chinese asserted the United States has no right to defend Chinese territory in our region, and we complied. Right, that would be the parallel to Venezuela.
So I'm curious how you kind of stumbled upon the view that the Venezuela debt crisis, because again, it was something that not a lot of people are familiar with. Matter of fact, it was one of the reviews of your book that I loved was talking about that somebody had mentioned that basically you filled in the gap in history that nobody ever talks about, you know, between the Civil War and World War One, and this was one of those major points.
Yeah, I love the obscure 1895 Venezuela boundary crisis so much. I didn't know it before I started doing the research for this book. In fact, there were a lot of things I didn't realize. I knew when I started writing this book that I was onto a great question, which is what makes for peaceful transition between a dominant power and a rising challenger. But I actually thought I was going to write a political science book, right? That I was going to identify the five or six peaceful transitions, and I was going to draw lessons from them and then apply it to our contemporary age. I didn't realize there's only one peaceful transition between a rising challenger and a dominant rule-giving power, and that's Britain and the United States. The other thing I didn't realize is that the Venezuelan debt crisis of 1895 is when that transition actually occurs. And what happened, it's such a wonderful story. It's so unduly obscure because there are so many elements about it that are the fun and games of American uniqueness. So Britain and Venezuela had been disputing where the boundary between their two territories, Britain being a colonial power, of course, where their two territories would lie. They've been disputing this for like 45 years. And it comes to a head in 1895 because an American hired by the Caudillo running Venezuela as a lobbyist starts writing newspaper editorials in American newspapers saying that President Grover Cleveland was failing to enforce the Monroe Doctrine, which had been established American policy for 70 years. And wasn't this a disgrace? And it's true that Cleveland wasn't a fan of the Monroe Doctrine. In fact, he was so anti-imperialist that he would not proceed with the annexation of Hawaii as an American territory. He believed that violated the sovereignty of the Hawaiian people. And Cleveland essentially gets stampeded by a swift-footed American lobbyist working for the Venezuelan government into having to have an opinion on the Venezuelan debt crisis. Venezuela had defaulted on its debt. Britain had landed Marines at the port of Corinto and started taking import receipts, right? Confiscating money in order to pay off the debt of a private British company, which was pretty standard British practice at the time. The U.S. challenges it. Cleveland ran a kind of loose cabinet-style government. His Secretary of State, Olney, gallops off the reservation with this 1,200-word assertion of American dominance that ends by saying American law is practically fiat on this continent. The British think it's so ridiculous they don't even reply to it, which is an affront to Grover Cleveland, which finally gets him involved in this. Cleveland pushes back on the British. The British respond that they control as much territory on the American continents as the United States does, so they're not about to allow us to unilaterally assert this kind of nonsense. Cleveland does what every successful American foreign policy president does, which is appeal to the United States Congress for reckless reendorsement of his policy. And he gets a unanimous vote out of both houses of Congress for his policy towards Venezuela, which includes going to war with the strongest power in the international order. The American fleet in the Caribbean at that time consisted of only 6 ships.
I know.
So there's no doubt that the British would have won this engagement. And yet we assert a new set of rules and the British capitulate. So that's why it's the inflection point.
So Corey, you have said repeatedly that you're not a historian. I'm not sure I believe you any longer on that point.
I thank you for that high praise.
Steve?
You know, I actually love these conversations because they add so much richness to the context of what we're discussing. And I'm like Bob, I'm a big fan of the idea of inflection points in history. Whether you're looking at at a discussion between two, a rising and a falling hegemon, or the transition between them, or you're looking at a simple tactical situation, it is so informative to be able to look at history and then pick inflection points where a situation could have turned one way or another, and then over time you see how that drives a tidal wave into a certain direction. Going back to that discussion
of
inflection points. I'm sorry, what?
I said I love that description.
I do the same in just about everything I write. I try to find those inflection points that cause people or cause events to shift in one way or another. I'm not a political scientist, not a historian, just a storyteller. But I want to go back to the idea of apart from the Venezuelan crisis, if you'd be willing to share your thoughts on some of the other inflection points that you touched on in the book, and which ones you saw as not equally impactful but significant in their own right.
Yeah, so I picked 9 different points in time where the United States, as a rising power, tried to change the rules of the international order. So the first one was 1823, the Monroe Doctrine, which you guys probably know, but I didn't when I started writing the book, was actually a British proposal for us to do bilaterally. And the U.S. takes it and runs off with it and asserts that no European power has the right to establish colonies on the entirety of North and South America. And we lack the ability to enforce that for another 70 years. But by shrewd diplomacy, we assert a new set of rules that the British do not agree to, but their interests are enough aligned that the Royal Navy basically enforces that for the United States for the intervening 70 years. But we try and change the rules and we can't in that instance. The second instance I look at is the Oregon boundary crisis of 1845. As you guys probably know, when James K. Polk was running for president, he not only asserted that we should go to war with Mexico because the government of Mexico lacked the ability to protect American settlers living in what is now California, New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, from Indian depredations, but he also asserted that we should go to war with Great Britain because our joint sovereignty over what was then known as the Oregon Territory, Oregon, Washington, some of Montana and Wyoming, that because Britain wasn't a democracy, that government had no right to assert sovereignty over American settlers in this territory. And again, that would have upended the international order to suggest that the United States, the only democracy, was the only sovereign power with legitimate right over its populations. And the British wait until we're at war with Mexico before starting to march troops westward in Canada and starting to move a fleet from the Caribbean to be able to enforce the rules of order that they saw. What is so interesting for me about the Oregon boundary crisis is that it's the first time that British citizens living in Britain begin to be a winnable constituency on American arguments. So we have the ability to play in Britain's domestic politics because of our Republican ideology. And so that's an interesting dawning of something unique to the United States as a rising power, because most countries have a very difficult time getting domestic resonance for their arguments, right? So for China to say, the United States should want to live the way people in China have to live, right? You get laughed off the stage making that argument in the United States. But the U.S., because of our ideology, has the ability to win domestic political support in other countries. So that's why that one was so interesting. I look at the Civil War, which was when the British had the possibility of severing the strength of the rising United States by supporting the Confederacy. And they choose not to for a series of reasons that mostly have to do with the American ability to play in British domestic politics. Namely, the Palmerston government believed it would be more difficult to continue to rule Ireland and Scotland if they allied themselves with the Confederacy, since 90% of immigrants to the United States by that point in time were coming from Ireland and Scotland and going to the industrial North. So the familial connections that linked American citizens to Ireland and Scotland really worried the government that controlled Ireland and Scotland. The next one I look at isn't a crisis so much as a moment in time when both the United States and Britain are kind of fumbling to find their new national mythology. And for the United States, it's the conquest of the American West, and the way that resonates through our sense of ourselves. The U.S., because of westward expansion, comes to think about itself in imperial terms. And Britain, in this same time period, is groping for its national storyline. And the peaceful expansion of the democratic franchise is what they come up with. So in a crucial kind of setting up period for the American challenge to British dominance, the U.S. comes to think of itself in imperial terms, and Britain comes to think of itself as a democracy. So we look similar to each other and different from every other country in the international order. And that, I think, is what makes the transition peaceful. Because when we come to crises, this sense of similarity buys political leadership the space to compromise. And that's what's unique about the transition. So then I look at the Venezuelan debt crises in 1895 and 1905. I look at World War I. I look at the Spanish-American War. I had wanted to end the book with the Washington Naval Accords of 1923, because it's the first time that the U.S. really asserts a set of rules for the international order and forces British compliance. So Britain wants something different, and we don't care. And then I look at World War II as the closing chapter of this story, one where the United States is so strong, it can easily force British compliance, and Britain can't achieve its aims without our assistance. And then I turn to look at what we can learn from this transition from Britain to the United States. What can we learn from that in thinking about the rise of China? So that's the book, guys.
Okay. I can't thank you enough. I mean, you basically just ran down the whole book, which kind of wasn't the intent there, but it's wonderful. Bob, I know you're waiting to jump in here.
That finish was a great segue to my question. So, Corey, Stansfield Turner, when he was president of the Naval War College, had his students read Thucydides to discuss.
Yay!
to discuss Vietnam. Oh, by the way, I loved your article on the summer of misreading Thucydides. Classic.
But thank you.
Your book provides an opportunity to discuss hegemonic shifts in a period of rising global powers. Now, while Thucydides doesn't mention Vietnam, you do, as you said, end your book with your views on China. While you can read a lot about China overtaking the U.S. economically, their reclamation of islands and militarization of those islands, their global spread. However, you've also mentioned their problems they're having with demographics, rising pluralism, and outright bullying of their neighbors driving them to the U.S. sphere. Do you believe the U.S. is really in danger of a hegemonic shift to China?
I do think the U.S. is in danger of it, but not because of China, but because of our own reckless disregard for our advantages in this time of American dominance. That, there's this wonderful passage in Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida, which is about the Trojan War, in which an exasperated Odysseus complains to his fellow Greeks that Troy in our weakness stands, not in its strength. And I think about that all the time right now, because practically any American statesman through history would prefer to have our contemporary problems to the problems that they actually had to deal with. And yet we delude ourselves to think the world is, so complicated now, and our challenges are so demanding. Nobody's ever had it this hard. And that is such a self-indulgent series of excuses that if we would do two or three things right, we could secure American hegemony for another century at least. One would be get our financial house in order, stop spending money we don't have. The second would be to really sink deep roots in consolidation of North America, Mexico, Canada, and the United States as a common immigration platform, a common power grid, electrical power grid, so that you have the flow of energy across the three countries. That would be such an easy pickup. And actually, the Canadians and Mexicans are yearning for it from us. But we're acting like the Mexicans are somehow a danger rather than good neighbors. And the third big thing we ought to do right that we're currently failing at is to remember, as Thucydides teaches us, that strong allies are an enormous force multiplier. And if you look at the challenges, for example, that China poses to the United States, a rapidly accelerating economy, the innovation that begins to drive Chinese companies, a government that views itself as the handmaiden and enforcer of its businesses, China's doing a lot of things right, but they're also doing a lot of things wrong in ways that will make their ability to become a hegemonic power more difficult and much more expensive if they manage to get there. And, you know, China doesn't have any friends. It doesn't have any allies. It doesn't have anyone who views itself as being strengthened by its Chinese relationship. And the U.S. does, right? What China has done in its behavior in the South and East China Seas has been to reinforce America's alliance relationships at a time we are burning through international goodwill like a wildfire.
Sure.
If we played our own hand a little smarter, we wouldn't have to worry about China. But there definitely is the possibility of a transition because we're playing a very strong hand very stupidly.
Do you think, though, that China's having any luck in buying friends, such as in Africa?
Yeah, they are in the near term. But we know what this looks like, right? It's United Fruit in Honduras in the 1920s.
Right.
That the reason American hegemony has been of such long duration is largely because everybody else really wants us to succeed, that we have created a set of rules of order by which others benefit as well as us benefiting, right? That we don't maximize what we are getting out of the international order because we understand that it benefits us dramatically to have others want the order we have established to continue. And for the most part, they do. And they do because we are so much less predatory than any other dominant power has ever been. And while we don't always hold ourselves to account, we and our allies, for the most part, do. And that makes us a safer bet with power than anybody else who's a contender.
Yep. Thank you for making that distinction.
Wow.
Yeah. Steve?
So I want to jump in here because my next question was going to be related to one of my favorite quips to throw out when I discuss China with people is that China doesn't want to fight us, they want to be us. And my question was going to be, why can't China be us? And you answered that question before I could ask it. So I'm going to jump on the other half of the question, which is the prohibitive nature of clash between potential hegemons. And I have always said I don't believe China would ever want to fight us because they can look and see the financial risk that holds for them and what it would prevent them from becoming us. But we still have to play with that idea. And I know you know Pete Singer, and he and August Cole in their book Ghost Fleet, which I'm sure you probably had a chance to read by now, describes
that
future hegemonic clash between China and the United States. And it has a very unClancy-like ending, which is, you know, a stalemate, which just I give both of them a hard time because, come on, if you're going to be a modern Tom Clancy, you've got to come to a great conclusion where the United States wins and everybody's happy. But we don't do that. So in your mind, how do you think such a clash would play out?
So, I read the ending of Ghost Fleet different than you do, which is, I don't think it ends as a stalemate. I think the sacrifice of the fleet in order to get the new weapons firing and mowing through the Chinese fleet. I think actually I read Ghost Fleet as the United States having the good fortune to have the time to get its act together and push back on the Chinese invasion. The second thing I loved about Ghost Fleet was the reminder that Americans are good insurgents, right? We've been on the other side of the insurgency equation for 15 years now, and we forget the fact that, like, we're the original of this, right?
Yeah.
And we're really good at it as a society. And other things that I think are useful lessons from Ghost Fleet. First, we are wrong to believe that our technology is going to be the only technology that matters.
Thank you.
Second,
yeah, absolutely, yeah.
How much allies matter and how often deaf we are when they are trying to help us, right? The Russian character in Ghost Fleet, who keeps trying to tell us what's coming, and we keep not listening. The other thing that, so what I tease August Cole about all the time is how sentimental Ghost Fleet is, right? That we're the only people who have the right kind of patriotism. The Chinese have a conceited and sense of dominance that's driven by arrogance, but we don't have that. And
of course
that's
not
a very sentimental read of the United States, right?
Maybe a little bit of arrogance.
They could have told the same story emphasizing the arrogance of the United States, believing that we can rely on this magic weapon to save us. So lazy and sloppy with all of the talent that comes our way. They chose to tell it in a very romantic way where, you know, the decency and humble leadership of that magnificent commander is what gets us where we need to get, right? Like, and his father sacrificing himself, it's beautiful. But the Chinese may be just as capable of those kinds of fine human qualities, even in the Chinese military, as those guys suggest. So I love Ghost Fleet. I think it's a wonderful story. I think it's a great teaching story about the United States in a time of dominance being just too lazy and just too sloppy. And by the way, part of how we turn it around is a serial killer who's an American. Which also a weird, wonderful touch. So I read that terrific novel slightly different than you do, but I do think you are right that the Chinese are unlikely to risk a major military confrontation with the United States anytime soon, both because of the breadth of our strength, but also because of that diabolical build a better mousetrap, figure it out. You know, what America's adversaries ought to understand is don't leave us time to fix our mistakes. Because we're, as a military and as a society, we're not that good at having it right, but we're genuinely brilliant at getting it right.
Yes.
Right? That's the North Africa campaign at the start of World War II. That's all of Pershing's mistakes in his arrogance insisting that Americans don't need to fill in British and French units, that we're just as good as fighting World War I as they are, which is ludicrous and results in a lot of unnecessary American casualties in World War I. But we're good at figuring it out.
Churchill would agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he would agree with us. One of my favorite arguments I've ever had with Jim Mattis was over the launching of the Normandy invasion, which, you know, when I was writing my book, Safe Passage, I was thinking my way through World War II, and Jim was still at Stanford at the time, and we were arguing about me taking the side of Leahy and the American commanders in World War II, who were pushing back on FDR all the time to try and get us to pivot to the Pacific, because the British were just, in their view, using us to reestablish their colonial holdings and not really willing to confront Hitler. And Jim kept saying, what the British understood that we didn't is the American military would have lost, would have been unable to establish the beachhead before we had had the experience of fighting in North Africa and Italy.
Right.
And, you know, I'm prepared to believe he knows something about that equation that I understand less well than he does. So I see it in the argument.
Oh, absolutely. Those are arguments that play out really well in Rick Atkinson's trilogy.
Yes, yes, yes. I love Army at Dawn, may be one of the best books ever written about the American military, I think.
But it really underscores our ability to learn as we go. And
yeah.
Painful lessons indeed, but you know, we still have an ability to learn as we go.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Hopefully that will continue.
Yes.
Yeah. That would be
the
good.
The Republic actually depends on it.
So,
but I can tell you, the American military is now behind the rest of society on this, right? 13-year-old girls in Los Angeles saying, hey, how come my lip gloss doesn't have breath freshener in it? And
I often ask myself the same question.
We are such an innovative society, and our military is has some catching up to do with the rest of American society.
Check. So one of the things your book kind of lays out is how a peaceful hegemonic shift, you know, it occurs over time. And as you said, the number of peaceful hegemonic shifts is N equals one, whereas the majority have been, you know, through war, World War One, World War Two. History is replete with those examples. But I want to talk about is a possibility of N equaling two. In the Atlantic Monthly a couple years ago, you wrote an article with Anya Manuel where you talked about your views on China's odds, but you also talked about how we're getting it and managing India's rise well. You can make an argument that they are also democratic. There is a potential for shared values. And as India continues to rise, and certainly not in the next 10 years, but I'm looking out like 2040 and beyond, is there a potential for a gradual hegemonic shift towards what in 40 years will be the largest nation, potentially with the largest economy?
So being the hegemon means being the rule setter. And for India to replace the U.S. as a hegemon, it would have to be operating on a different set of rules than we are. And the genius of the American-led liberal order is that it's broad enough and expansive enough to incorporate rising powers. Right. So Shockey's theory of course is that we don't go to war with rising powers, right? They're nationalistic, they're militaristic, they're nouveau riche. Basically they're a lot like us. And so we understand them and we figure out ways that they can get what they want while we still continue to get what we want. And the genius of the rules of order we have put in place is that it allows other countries to become prosperous. It allows other countries to become influential. But for another hegemon to emerge, they would actually have to change those rules, as opposed to come on in, the water's fine, be as powerful and as rich as Germany is now, or the European Union is now, right? It's not supplanting the U.S. as a hegemon, because it's playing by the same rules. And so the question I would ask you about a rising India is, what makes you think they want a different set of rules, as opposed to, in their own, you know, fits and starts way, becoming more and more a participant in the order in the way Australia is, Japan is, Britain is, Germany is?
Right.
What do you think the rules that they would want to have different are?
So I guess, and this is where I have to plead my ignorance and lack of understanding, in that, you know, India looks at the Indian Ocean as being their sphere, and with the rising India, and as you defined that you cannot have a dual hegemony before, I can see India as wanting to be the dominant power in that part of the world, certainly within the Indian Ocean and extending across it. However, and I agree with you that while they may look and seek the same set of rules as we do, I think as they rise, they may want to be the enforcer of those rules within their sphere, which I guess gets to your point is that's good for us. That allows us to kind of spread our values and maintain our hegemony. And certainly, as we talked before in your article about misreading Thucydides, there are many that would claim that as a rising power, we must do something about it. So thanks for clarifying that again. But I just see them wanting to be, I guess, more influential, controlling more trade. You know, during the Cold War, they were neutral trending Soviet. Now they're neutral trending U.S. And
that's a great description of India, neutral trending U.S.
But the thing is, they have always maintained their neutrality. And I think because of, as opposed to forming alliances. And that's where, you know, I think that they may have a different world order that they're looking for, because they have not declared an alliance with the U.S., even though we have reached out to them for that reason.
Okay, so I have a couple of responses to that. First, if I am right, and America's alliances are a major reason both that we became the hegemon and that remaining hegemon is sustainable at a reasonable cost. If alliances are the key to those two things, then India is unlikely to be able to gather enough strength to become a hegemon without developing alliance relationships. Right? So how does India, I don't know what their per capita GDP is, but it's nowhere near in the neighborhood of the United States. So how do they get strong enough to have a navy that can force the U.S. out of the Indian Ocean when everybody else is going to help us keep the rules current in the Indian Ocean? I think the way to bet your money on India is actually that they are slowly acclimatizing themselves to wanting to be a responsible stakeholder in the existing order, which would prevent any power from being able to change the existing rules of order in the Indian Ocean, which are the free flow of commerce, the existing law of the sea, right? It serves India incredibly well because they don't have to develop the capacity to enforce those rules. We and others help them enforce so they can share the burden of it. And my read of the Indians is that you're exactly right on neutral trending U.S., but they are starting to opt in to activities with the U.S., Japan, Australia, South Korea. So I think they see the advantages and they lack the capacity to enforce the rules of order or to change them without an awful lot more help than they appear to have.
I need to go back to this, though, because if you think about the Chinese model, they knew they had to grow their economy. They went to an export-based economy, now realizing that to maintain an economy, they have to shift to a consumer economy. India kind of skipped the export-based economy, went straight to a consumer-based economy, which, you know, for a long run will provide, I think, be much better for them in the long term. And so while I completely agree that within the next 10 to even 20 years, you know, that economy, you know, will still be growing and they don't have the military capacity. I just look at out to, like I said, about 2040 is the date I've picked. Where they may have a strong enough economy. I think by the 2030s, you know, as China continues to grow, that India will want to play catch up. And I don't know, maybe it's just a paranoia on my part or trying to think, okay, you know, who the next rising power will be. I keep my eye on India for that reason.
Okay.
Yep.
My theory of how hegemons behave is that they try and create the international order in the image of their domestic order, right? Because it's what feels comfortable to them.
Check.
That's why to be so worried about a rising China, because none of us want to live by the rules Chinese citizens are forced to live by. But the rules that Indians live by, you know, if they can get corruption under control, they are a big, vibrant, diverse democracy. And so if India were to become the hegemon of the international order, that would probably look pretty familiar and pretty comfortable to the United States.
Exactly.
In the way that the American order looks pretty comfortable to Great Britain.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. We've only got a few minutes left, so I kind of wanted to shift gears a bit, if you're okay with that. And first of all, you were kind enough, and I thank you for it, to share a chapter to the Military Writers Guild anthology on writing. And I think I probably leaned on you a little hard for that, but...
I loved it that you guys let me contribute to it. Let me be part of something that I think is really important and gives us all the opportunity to share kind of what the experience was like for us.
And that is kind of what I want to get at, is that the idea behind that was to get down to what motivates people, what drives that passion to write. So with you, what is it? Why do you write?
I write because it's a way to have a conversation with other people about issues that I think are really important. You know, what I look like to myself fundamentally is a school teacher. I'm Winslow Homer's prairie school teacher, standing at a chalkboard, talking to farm boys about geometry. And the written word is how you communicate complex ideas from one person to another. So I write to be able to engage other people about ideas that I think are important.
Wow. And that's pretty much it in a nutshell. Bob?
As I was going through and researching for this, first off, I want to congratulate you on your 4-H victories.
thank you.
Very, very impressive. So if somebody was to describe to me, you know, have me describe Corey Shockey, I would not have picked that she had raised cattle. But that's awesome.
I thank you for that. But for those who don't know the story, I earned my first spending money by arbitraging cattle. I would buy runt calves from the dairies in my dusty little cow town, raise them on bottled milk, and auction them off at the fair. And that's how I made my spending money.
But in the same article, and I think I got this right, you said your dream job would be DepSec State for management and resources. I'm just curious as to why and if that has changed.
Yes, it is a job I would love. And the reason is because the State Department is an organization that underperforms its talent by a very wide margin. And my experience working in the State Department was that it's a place of such amazing talent that nobody cares enough about to manage well. And I had the contrasting experience of working in the Pentagon when I was starting out professionally. And, you know, the American military makes a lot out of average talent, right? Because the entirety of the institution arrays itself to take an 18-year-old girl who can't get a job in a gas station, but they think they think she has the aptitude to do something important for the country. And they set her up to be successful. They identify whether she has those aptitudes. They teach and train her to excel at them. They promote her for her future potential. And when I got to the State Department, it was shocking to me that the leadership of the organization did none of those things. That by their own definition, they are not recruiting the talent that they believe they need, but they're recruiting it because it's what they know how to recruit. They spend all of their teaching and training. First of all, they don't do any training other than on-the-job mentorship, which is fundamentally unfair, because if you end up assigned to an ambassador that doesn't care about that, then you are disadvantaged all the way going forward. So they don't have a leveling ground of teaching and training. They expend all of their resources on teaching languages and yet do not teach it well enough that most American ambassadors can argue on television and with the leadership of the country they're stationed in the native language. And so because the people who tend to go as senior political appointees in the State Department are people who care about foreign policy, there's nobody who's the equivalent of the Deputy Secretary of Defense who just cares about the management of the organization. And I think I could do that extremely well in the State Department and would love the opportunity to help them bring American diplomacy to where our country needs it to be.
Which is great, because actually the first book of yours that I read was State of Disrepair. And I loved it. So thanks for the quick analysis of that book. Steve, I will kick it over to you for the last question.
All right. Doggone, I have a whole bunch of them here that I wanted to throw at you. But it's interesting that you make that point, because probably about 8 years ago, I was with John Herbst, the former coordinator for Reconstruction and Stabilization, at an event. And we were in the green room beforehand, and he made a comment about that the future success of the State Department was going to rely on developing an entire new generation of foreign service officer to deal with a world that had fundamentally changed from his generation. And at the same time, not being confident that there was a process within the department that would allow that. And
that's exactly right.
Yeah, and I've watched that play out over the past 8 years or so. And so it's amazing that you would make that comment, and timely as well. It's something that every time we have a new Secretary of State and we hear grumblings about, well, this isn't the way we've done things and this isn't what we should do, I think back to John Herbst's comments and think, well, it's what the department needs. We've got to find the will to make these kinds of changes happen. And having served in embassies overseas and had frank conversations over dinner with foreign service officers who knew that they weren't going to be developed and they weren't going to get the kinds of assignments that needed to be developed, and so they were just trying to make the most of the experience that they could, oftentimes serving in less than ideal circumstances, talent that was never going to be developed or utilized. So Bob threw the last question at me, and I'm going to throw one. This is an easy one. It's a softball, but what's your next big project?
Thank you so much for asking that.
You're welcome.
I am right now engaged in writing a monograph, and so 10,000 words, and I owe it a week from now to the Lowy Institute in Australia, about whether the international order is sustainable without American leadership. Because I think that's where we are right now.
Wow.
And so I want to celebrate the examples of liberal allies trying to step forward and sustain the order, to buy time for the United States to come to our senses. So the example of Canada, Australia, and Japan keeping the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership working, even without the United States, the way that Canada is, for example, working collaboratively with American businesses and American state governments on trade policy and other things. So reaching into our body politic when our federal government is unwilling to cooperate. My favorite example of this is, hilariously enough, the country that is very likely to first meet its Paris Climate Accord goals is going to be the United States of America. Right? We've withdrawn from the treaty. The federal government is overtly hostile to it. And the great state of California and the great city of Chicago and Apple Corporation are all driving compliance irrespective of the federal government.
Don't share that with Scott Pruitt.
I'm pretty confident he's not even going to notice. But those are ways that the liberal order gets sustained without American leadership. So maybe the next round of American leadership isn't the federal government. Maybe it's globally dominant and American companies. Maybe it's states and localities that band together to circumvent the federal government. Maybe it's American allies acting in concert when the United States won't act. So I'm exploring those different possibilities and trying to guess how much time might that buy us.
Hopefully enough.
Yeah, I feel the same because I really don't want to live in a Chinese-dominated international order.
That's not high on my list.
Wow. Yeah, I feel like I ought to have the right to try and talk my way out of speeding tickets rather than have them automatically dispensed to me.
Well, I would love to continue this conversation on, because I could easily go for another hour about how large corporations are supplanting governments in global influence. That's a great topic. But we're getting to a close here. Corey, I want to thank you so much for your time this morning.
Oh, yeah.
It has been a true pleasure. And
it has been a real joy, gentlemen. Thank you for such a smart conversation. I really appreciate that you gave me the opportunity and that you made it so worthwhile.
Oh, and thanks for taking out on Sunday. Definitely.
And thanks again. And remember, if it's Sunday, it's the smell of victory.